It's to the best of our knowledge. When times are grim, when the future is uncertain, when you need more hope, can you make it? And if so, how?
I hope, because I know this just can't be the best version of the world that we can have. And I think that that's real for a lot of people.
This is CNN breaking news. Violence erupting on the streets out St. Louis. These are incredible pictures coming in. Police in riot gear firing tear gas to break up protesters angry over the shooting death of an unarmed teenager.
18-year-old Michael Brown.
DeRay McKesson's path to hope began on the day a lot of people lost theirs.
Mike got killed on August 9th, and I drove down to St. Louis on August 16th, largely because I just wanted to see with my own eyes. When I looked on CNN, it looked like the protesters were sort of wild. When I looked on Twitter, it looked like the police were really wild, and I just wanted to see for myself what was happening.
That's one police cruiser that is fully engulfed right now. You can hear the explosions going on inside, whether it's... Sorry, I just got hit by a rock.
And the second night I was in St. Louis was the first night that I was tear gassed. There was so much tear gas on the night of the no indictment that you couldn't see anymore, but you'd just be walking down the street and all of a sudden it just hit you, right? And there were so many nights like that where we were in the midst of what felt like a war zone. Nobody should ever have to live through this or experience this, and I'll do whatever I can to make sure that people don't.
Get those tear gas, man. Here they go. Get those tear
gas. Snipers.
And when I think about how I learned hope, it was like in these really hard moments. I remember hiding under my steering wheel. I remember sleeping on the side of the road. I remember all of those things. We were committed to stay in the street as long as possible, and the police response to us was just so wild.
You may no longer be in the area. It's no longer a peaceful protest.
People forget that we were in the street for 400 days.
You need to disperse immediately or you will be subject to arrest. Do it now.
In those early days, it was illegal to stand still. If we sit still for more than 5 seconds, we were immediately arrested, and that was one of the reasons why we marched so much, because we had to. It wasn't really a choice. And I think the police thought that that was gonna cause us to go home, and instead it furthered our resolve. We gotta walk, you gotta walk, and we just stayed out all night, all day, and it was really powerful. You know, I'm proud to be one of many people who stayed, one of many people who fought, one of many people who pressed, because we knew we were right, right? Like, we knew that at best, Michael Brown might have been guilty of jaywalking and that the penalty for jaywalking wasn't death.
Hope means the ability to still
our
be here,
best futures
fighting.
Hope right there in your face.
Hope,
at the moment.
Optimism, happiness.
Hope works. Hope is essential.
Hope rises. She always does.
I'm Anne Strandchamps. Welcome to Hope, a 3-part series from To the Best of Our Knowledge. And here we are at episode 2. How do you make hope?
Hope is connected to faith.
Of what use is love if the situation is hopeless?
Let's do hope.
So that story we heard is from DeRay McKesson. He's a former 6th grade math teacher and one of the most prominent activists to emerge from the Black Lives Matter movement. You might know him because of his podcast, or maybe for his signature blue vest. Shannon Henry Kleiber thought we should talk with him about hope.
DeRay, this is Shannon.
Hey, Shannon.
Hey, how are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm okay. So I wanted to start with, I am usually a pretty optimistic person, but lately everyone seems so angry and there's so much political fighting. There's climate change we're worried about, and I get overwhelmed with the day-to-day news. How can we get beyond this? How can we have hope?
Yeah, I think about hope as a belief that our tomorrows can be better than our todays. And I think that what you see all across the country is hope work. You see people running for office. You see people engaged in electoral politics, joining committees, and that sort of stuff. You certainly see people out in the street And you see people publicly saying that this can be better. And I think that that is actually what hope is. So when King says that the more arc of the universe bends towards justice, that's about faith. But when we say it bends because people bend it, that's a hope statement.
I love how you talk about hope as work. And what you're just saying is not easy. How do you talk to other people about it? What words do you use? How do you convince other people to do this work?
One of the questions is like, what are you interested in? Like, what do you think isn't working that you want to work? It's that simple. Most organizing starts off really small. The first thing I ever did in Ferguson was make peanut butter and jelly sandwiches. That was what I did, and that was how it started.
How did that happen? Did somebody say, hey, we need some food? Who knows how to make something?
So there was just like an incredible sense of community in Ferguson in the very beginning. And I think sometimes people think of organizing as starting in like some grand way every time, but it often is like a set of neighbors saying, I don't think this streetlight should look like this, or I think there should be a streetlight. And then people get together and start organizing it. I think about us in the street in St. Louis. We didn't join a group. We weren't in a club. But we did something that was so special, and we did it all together that changed the mood of the country.
I like that. I think that one of those lessons is start somewhere. Don't just think you can't do it.
Yeah, and that one of the ways that the status quo continues to thrive is that it convinces you that you don't have any power, that you feel like you are like this helpless person, your one vote doesn't matter. Like, that's how the status quo endures, because the people who are feeding you that message are the people voting every single time, right? They're heavily involved, but they're banking on the fact that you won't be involved.
So what's your advice to people who are losing hope?
Yeah, I think that, you know, when we say the system is broken, and some people say that it's not broken, it's functioning exactly like it was designed. One of our takeaways is that it was designed, right? And because it was designed, we can make something else. Somebody made this up. And if they can remake the tax code and the back of napkins and paper towels, we can actually do all of this in a generation, right? They're like, this doesn't have to be a 10-generation solution. We can do this pretty quickly. When I see people's hope waning, it's like, remember that people made this up. This isn't like divine. Like, we can actually do this. And I've seen people get mobilized all across the country. It's a little slow. Sometimes change doesn't happen as much as we want it to, but like, it moves, you know?
You've seen it change.
Yeah.
So do you ever feel like the anger is helpful?
I think the anger is helpful all the time. You know, it was early in the protest that I had to figure out what to do with the anger, that I had thought that I needed to move the anger out of the way. But really, part of this work is about saying that the anger just can't overpower the other emotions, but we shouldn't have to try to erase the anger. And I'm always reminded that we didn't bring the violence, right? Like, the only reason I'm in the middle of the street is because the police killed somebody. I didn't do this. I didn't start this. I'd love to be back in a classroom being a teacher. I'd love to do that work. I'm doing this work because I have to.
Tell me a little bit about your childhood. You grew up in...
I grew up in Baltimore.
In Baltimore. What was that like?
Great. You know, it was a small... It's like a big, small city. So my world was pretty small in Baltimore. I grew up as a youth organizer in the city and did a lot of student government and things like that from my entire time in school, and did that in college too. But Baltimore was good. Both of my parents were addicted to drugs. My father raised us. My mother left when I was 3. So I grew up in a community of recovery, like helping people, watching people put their lives back together. So that was interesting and really influenced the way that I thought about communities coming together and what it means to make amends and how people can heal and recover. So that's really powerful. And then me and my sister, we both grew up and became teachers, which was sort of unexpected.
You were a 6th grade math teacher in Brooklyn, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot about my students is that, like, I have responsibilities as an adult to try and make the world a better place. I went down to St. Louis because they killed a teenager. Mike Brown was a teenager, and he should be alive today. So my commitment to young people is, I think, the thing that I rest on when things get really hard, knowing that we have a responsibility to make the system better for other people. So I think about the police. It's like, we know the outcomes are really bad, right? So we know that a third of all the people killed by a stranger in this country is killed by a police officer. We know that 1 in 11 gun homicides in California is committed by an officer. And there are structural things that almost guarantee that officers will never be held accountable. So like in California, there's a law that says any investigation of an officer that lasts more than a year will never result in discipline. Like, there are a host of those things that people don't realize, but really are the way the system works. And I spent a considerable amount of time working on those things to just try and figure out, like, how do we peel it back? Most of the things that people experience in community are the result of something that happened at the system level.
So you've got a big fan base, and they know you by your vest, and they are reading your book. They're getting what you're doing. Do you also talk to people who don't agree with you? And how do those conversations go?
You know, I always try and take it back to the simplest parts of the work, is that I believe we can live in a world where the police don't kill people. I don't think that's like a dramatic idea. You know, in Cleveland, the police department destroys disciplinary records of police officers every 2 years. I think that's generally a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. So like some of this is pretty basic, and I try to make it as basic as possible. Some of the people that ostensibly say they disagree with me or people like me want to use these really emotional arguments about police officers have hard jobs and it's a hard world. And like all of that can be true, and we still shouldn't delete police officer records. All that can be true, and we still shouldn't, officers shouldn't walk into somebody's apartment and say that they think it's theirs and shoot them dead, right? All of those things can be true, and we still can have a system of justice that isn't predicated on killing people, and we don't have that yet. So I try to just boil it down to like the basic elements when I'm talking to people who agree with me or who don't agree with me, because the positions that we have aren't really radical, I don't think.
So you're in a studio in Baltimore right now, and I can't see you, but I am guessing you're wearing a blue vest.
I am.
And can you tell us a little bit about why you're wearing that blue vest? And is there ever a moment you won't need to wear it anymore?
Yeah, I don't think it's about need. You know, it is important to me. So we were in the street for 400 days. It got cold and I needed something I could wear that I wouldn't have to pack because we were on the street all night. And the vest was easy. The vest was simple. I've had the vest for a while. And I still wear it because it reminds me that everything we went through happened. I'm in a lot of rooms now and we are seemingly far from those early days when we were out all night for 400 days. And I just never want to forget that that was real. I never want to forget how fragile freedom is. And me wearing this vest is like my reminder for myself. I never thought that it'd be a thing for other people, which it has become. But it just keeps me grounded and focused.
It's a symbol for you?
No, not a symbol for me. I think it's a symbol for other people. It's like a safety blanket for me. It's like it was with me the whole time. So I don't think about it. So other people, I think of it more as a symbol. It's sort of like it's in the same way that like some people have tattoos, you know? Most people wouldn't call their tattoo symbols, but it's like a thing that just is important to me as a reminder.
DeRay McKesson is an activist, a podcast host, and author of On the Other Side of Freedom, The Case for Hope. Shannon Henry Kleiber talked with him. You know, if I was a young person right now, in my teens or early 20s, I think I would resent the hell out of adults. Us? And coming of age on a planet that's been severely, maybe permanently damaged by the bad choices we made? That sucks. And parents like me often talk about how our kids give us hope, but sometimes I think that's an unfair burden. Take Lydia Hester. She's 17 years old. A junior in high school with a pile of AP classes, plus a nearly full-time job as an activist. She led her school's walkout for gun reform. She's organized climate change protests. She recently managed and won a city council campaign. She does all of that, and she's not even old enough to vote. And yes, that really bugs her.
Yeah. It's definitely really hard. I have about 6 months left until I can vote, and so I'm just counting down the days. But yeah, it definitely is really hard because when people say that they aren't going to vote, I'm like, can I have your vote? You know, like if you won't vote. And the other thing is that it's feeling very urgent, and especially with the climate change movement, this is our future. It's in the next 12 years, you know, that we damage won't be reversible, and that's very much in our lifetime.
I wanted to ask you about that because like, I was looking at the video recently of Greta Thunberg, the young Swedish activist, her speech to the billionaires at Davos,
right,
saying, I don't want your hope. I want you to panic. Mm-hmm. I was curious about your reaction.
Yeah, I really look up to Greta Thunberg. One of my favorite parts from one of her speeches was, I want you to act like the house is on fire.
Because it is.
Because it is, yes. And a lot of people, I think, know that this is urgent, but they are like, yes, something should be done about it. Just you should do it. I want something to be done, but as long as it doesn't affect the convenience of my life, you know? Mm-hmm. But this is something I learned in AP Environmental Studies this year, is everyone thinks that if, like, they fish in a lake, oh, it's just a few fish. It doesn't matter. But if everyone thinks that way, then there's going to be no more fish left. That's the same way with climate change. Everyone, if they can just take a small step for themselves, that will make a huge impact. People just need to be aware of that. And a lot of people don't.
Let's be frank. A lot of the people who don't see the urgency are my age or older. I mean, I look at videos of like you standing up and giving speeches or Greta Thunberg. And honestly, what I feel is this kind of grief and rage that our children are doing the work that adults should have.
Yeah.
Do you feel betrayed by former generations?
I mean, I guess I hadn't thought about it with that exactly being betrayed, but it's just such a big mess for us to pick up. Why should we have to do, you know, the work? We can be upset about it, but it's not going to do anything. We're still in the time that we're in, and we're going to have to clean up the mess anyway.
I think a lot of adults are incredibly heartened watching your generation kind of step up. Sometimes I feel like that's not really fair.
Yeah, I definitely feel hopeful when I'm seeing, you know, all of these other students who will come out. But there's also many moments where we feel completely hopeless about the movement. One thing that's really engraved in my memory is when we were sitting in the assembly chambers and we watched our bills just keep getting shut down. It does take a lot of toll on young people. I mean, just being a teenager and going to school is enough to make teenagers very stressed out. So then imagine adding all of this. You have the world on your shoulders, and it's up to you. And if you don't do it, nobody's going to.
Do you guys talk about that a lot? And do you and your friends talk about that?
It's not really talked about. All these people are so hopeful about it, you know? So I think a lot of us we just have to be hopeful all the time, you know? I mean, we definitely talk about how hard it is when we have these big defeats, but not as often as how great it feels when we have a win, you know?
Sort of like it's not okay to get discouraged.
Right.
We're this generation, we can't afford to get discouraged.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We need to put this front on that we have it all together, even though young people should not be expected at all to have it all together.
So you feel like you are, in a very real pragmatic sense, having to make decisions about your future based on your need to be politically active, except it's not your need, it's your generation's. It's all of our need.
Yeah. I'm being torn in different directions between what's best for myself and what's best for the world, you know? It feels like I'm being selfish if I just do what a normal teenager would do and just go off to college. I just think about, what if a seat for assembly, U.S. Senate or Congress or something, like, what if a seat opens up and I want to run for it, but I can't do that if I'm in college? People just tell me, like, just focus on what is best for you. But it's really hard for me to do that.
What helps when you feel like your hope is waning, you're feeling discouraged?
In all of these movements that I've been in, there's such a strong community. And so we can just lean on each other, even though we wish we didn't have to get together for this. Wish we could, you know, get together to go to the movies or something. But it's just the same as any friend group or like a sports team. And so I've made a lot of friends through this movement, which has been really helpful as well.
What do you want from us? What do you want the older generations to know or to think about or to do?
The biggest thing is to vote. Vote for the people who can't vote. And when you're voting, don't just think about yourself when you're in that voting booth. Think about all of the younger generations whose future this will be affecting. I mean, when people say that they don't do politics, that's coming from such a place of privilege to be able to say that none of these things are affecting them. Because if I said that I didn't do politics, that would be saying that I don't care about 80% of the kids in my school. Politics is every thing around us. It's affecting everyone, and I just would like people to realize that it's everyone's job to save our future, you know?
Lydia Hester is a junior at East High School in Madison, Wisconsin. When she's not doing homework or studying for the SAT, she's working on saving the future. What about you? Have you ever lost hope?
I think anyone who says they've never lost hope is not telling you the truth.
This is Serene Jones. She's the president of Union Theological Seminary.
I think a moment where many people lost hope in the state where I come from, Oklahoma, was the bombing of the Murrah Building by Timothy McVeigh. My former brother-in-law was injured in the bombing. My sister was working nearby. Children in the daycare in the building. Coming to grips with a guy who looked like he could have been one of my high school boyfriends, capable of this level of violence, I had to really wrestle then with my own rage, my utter rage at what had happened and the senselessness of it, and a loss of hope in the basic goodness of humanity.
There's tornadoes when towns are destroyed. We're used to going to the site, being able to help, being able to make a difference to the survivors, and right now there isn't a lot we can do for the survivors.
It was really a long process, and I finally, it was a spiritual journey for me to say, even in the face of such evil, because of the existence of the face of such evil, we must have hope and we must believe in goodness.
Coming up, more from Serene Jones on the moral and spiritual imperative to hope. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. Hope is deeply embedded in our spiritual traditions. It's one of the three cardinal virtues, and for a lot of people, belief in God is what gives them hope. Well, Serene Jones is the first woman to head the historic Union Theological Seminary in New York, and she says hope is also a political, a moral force. It's what drives people to organize, to work, to change the world. She told Steve Paulson that hope is where the spirit and the body politic come together.
The most profound challenge to one's hope is traumatic loss. It may be the loss of a loved one, maybe the loss of your own capacities. It may be your loss of trust and hope in the government, the community that you're a part of, your loss of hope and appreciation for others' goodness. I do think, though, at this particular moment in our nation,
the rates of despair and anxiety and loss of hope are profound. Profound.
I think there's this widespread feeling that things are just getting worse in the world and that the future is not going to be as good, maybe worse than what our parents had.
Yes, I think most young people feel that way. And I think people of all ages look around them and they see hatred, they see destruction of the environment, they see communities where people can't speak with one another, they see economic conditions declining. I mean, the list could go on. So the obvious concrete political reasons to hope or communal reasons to hope seem few and far between. But if one can connect to those you love, if you can connect to what inside of you is that impulse towards goodness, grace, love, then new life comes into you, even in the worst of circumstances. And the thing about hope is you have it even, for instance, if you believe we have crossed the point that we can bring our climate back into a space of health.
Why do you say we have it? A lot of people are actually losing it, specifically on this question of climate change.
No, that's exactly what I'm saying. You can, I mean, when I hear that from the scientists, I don't disagree with them. I mean, they know more about this than I do. But then there's all the more reason to live from now until as long as we live here with the hope that in the context in which we find ourselves, we can find goodness and work towards goodness and work towards the health of human community and the health of our general world, even, especially in the midst of that decline.
I guess what I'm hoping you can do for us today is to make the case that some kind of public theology or spiritual language is what we need today to give us hope or grace that's otherwise missing in our lives. And I'm also thinking for people who've rejected religion, why should they care about anything at all spiritual?
Well, what I see around me every day at the seminary, Union Theological Seminary, where I'm the president, is students pouring through our doors. A large majority of them don't come from any religious background, but there's nonetheless a deep spiritual yearning to find other people who are asking the big questions about the purpose of our lives. And until we have the courage, or until it becomes so insistent in it we can't resist it, to ask those questions about the meaning of it all, we feel lost and we feel desperate. And I don't think one needs to be religious to feel lost and desperate without a sense of purpose or goodness.
But there are an awful lot of atheists out there who would say they are the ones asking the big questions. The questions might be in science, maybe philosophy. How did everything begin? How did everything fit together? You know, our place in the universe.
And I think that I would call what they're doing theology. Now, I wouldn't say it's necessarily attached to what we think of as religion, but they're asking the big questions.
Boy, I know a lot of atheists who would really object to that idea. That
well,
no,
so
they're
it
doing
all depends
theology.
On how they understand theology. If they understand theology as a simple intellectual enterprise that religious people do, then that would be offensive. But if you stepped back and saw theology as the endeavor of asking the big questions about how it all fits together and what the purpose is, then theology takes on a different cast.
Where do you personally find hope?
Oh, I find hope in my students. Each year we open our doors to a new class of people from all over the world, from every different kind of circumstance and background, coming to seminary, trying to figure things out and do good in the world. The fact that people keep showing up to learn what it means to do good and how we do good together. I'm very fortunate in that regard that I get to see that every day.
It's so interesting that you say learning to do good rather than, say, learning religious history, learning what theologians have said about God. That's not how you're responding here.
Well, they do learn the histories of these various traditions, but all of these traditions, Christianity, Judaism, Buddhism, Islam, Hinduism, you name it, all of them say in the end that the truth of the knowledge, if you really grasp it, is in the good that you do. So if you are really learning and understanding these truths, then they transform you and you do good in the world. If you learn them and it has no effect on your positive actions, then you haven't really learned them at all, even though you may think you have.
Do you think you can do good or be a good person if you don't have hope?
I think that it is possible to have lost hope, but to despite yourself and your own unhappiness or despair, to still do kind and good things for others. There are people whose goodness runs so deep that even when they have lost their way, they're kind, gentle, and are positive presence in the world. But it's hard to sustain that.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's much harder.
Well, there was one of the formative people I read and thought a lot about years ago was Camus, his myth of Sisyphus.
Yeah.
Keep rolling up the rock, and it keeps falling down, but you keep doing it over and over and over, and in spite of what would seem to be hopeless situations. Or his later novel, The Plague, where, you know, in this horrible pestilence, the good doctor keeps going because he just, I mean, how could he not?
Yes. And that is sort of a soul-deep reckoning with the fact, as human beings, hope is what we need to have so we can get out of bed in the morning and keep moving through the world in a positive way, even when we know we're not going to be successful, we wake up and do it again. It's a choice between a life that is inspirited with love and a life that becomes lost.
Serene Jones is the first woman president of Union Theological Seminary. She's also the author of a new memoir, Call It Grace. And that was Steve Paulson talking with her. So while some people find their hope in faith, writer Megan Steelstra found her hope one day at a bookstore.
I knew something was wrong. I hadn't been reading. There are so many metaphors for depression in general, and postpartum specifically. Mountains, climbing over, waves, crashing down, fog, wandering through. I wandered through those first years of motherhood, and I wandered through the day-to-day of my day job, and I wandered through bookstores, picking up books, skimming first sentences, putting them down because I couldn't remember how to feel. And then one day, I will never forget this, I was at Women and Children First on the north side of Chicago. The bookseller said, "Megan, look at this." And with an almost eerie telepathy, she saw my insides, the fear and shame I couldn't yet understand, let alone articulate. She handed me a book. It had a gray wraparound cover. I opened it to the first page and read, "If you have ever fucked up in your life, or if the great river of sadness that runs through all of us has ever touched you, then this book is for you. Snap your fingers." That's how fast I started crying. And this was no single fragile tear cascading delicately down my cheek. This was a full-on ugly sob with the dry heaves and the snot and the mascara running everywhere. It was tragic and surprising. I didn't know those parts of me still worked. I didn't know language could still touch me. The book was called The Chronology of Water, named for its narrative structure and central metaphor of memory, not as linear, but as water, flowing, fragments, patterns. Its author, Lydia Yuknovich, calls it an anti-memoir, beginning with the delivery of her first child. "The day my daughter was stillborn," she wrote, "after I held the future pink and rose-lipped in my shivering arms, lifeless tender, covering her face in tears and kisses after they handed my dead girl to my sister who kissed her, then to my first husband who kissed her, then to my mother who could not bear to hold her, then out of the hospital room door, tiny, lifeless, swaddled thing. The nurse gave me tranquilizers and a soap and sponge. She guided me to a special shower. The shower had a chair, and the spray came down lightly, warm. She said, "That feels good, doesn't it? The water." Let's be direct. This book is hard. Loss, abuse, addiction, violence, but also, equally, if not more, there is joy and fun and heat. You'll be blushing, if not totally turned on, by the end of several sections. Pages 144, 159, and 235 for those taking notes. It's a book about love. It's a book about living. It's the book that got me living. I want to talk to you about Lydia the way that she talks about the writer Kathy Acker. Here's Lydia on Kathy. "I'd read sections and stop and look around expecting to get caught or smacked a red blotchy one. You can say this and it can be published?" In this way, her books saved me. Here is me on Lydia. "I'd read sections and run to the computer and write. I'd stay up all night long. I typed one-handed, two-fingered, holding my kid in the other arm. I wrote about climbing over and crashing down and wandering through. I wrote my way back to myself."
Megan Steelstra. She's the author of an essay collection called The Wrong Way to Save Your Life. And the book that saved her life? The Chronology of Water by Lydia Yuknovich.
Three and a half years ago, because of heart issues, I was in a coma. But my six sisters did not ever give up on me. Their hope is the reason I'm here.
I teach middle school in Northern California. Teenagers see the world with different eyes. They see different possibilities than I can see. The future is theirs, not mine. They give me hope.
Hope for the future is not enough. We have to have action. And our actions speak a lot louder than our words.
What about you? What gives you hope? We would love to know your thoughts. And we made it really easy to record your voice. You can just click a button on our website at ttbook.org/hope. Share your thoughts and they may wind up on the air. Coming up, hip-hop artist Common makes the case for hope and optimism, even or especially in hard times. I'm Ann Strangchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio. NPRX.
Thank you.
Our next guest doesn't really need an introduction, just his name should do it. Common. The first rapper ever to win an Emmy, an Oscar, and a Grammy. Okay, 3 Grammys to be exact. He's been performing recently in a supergroup called August Green, and they are, as the title of their debut album says, optimistic. Charles Monroe Kane wanted to know why.
Hello, Common. This is Charles.
Charles, peace. How you doing?
Peace to you, man. Exciting to have you on. I'm very pumped.
Thank you, man. What part of Wisconsin are you in?
Madison, Wisconsin.
Nice.
A little island of optimism and hope. So just so you know, you are in a show on hope. I thought you would like that. So.
I love that. You can win as long as you keep your head to the sky. Be
optimistic. When in the midst of sorrow. There's a song called Optimistic. You do it with Brandy, which is, she's amazing. And in many ways, the song is a pep talk. I'm going to read a couple lines. You can win as long as you keep your head to the sky. And another line, no matter how hard reality seems, just hold on to your dreams. How do you think lyrics like that ring for a young black man in America today?
Well, for young black men in America, I think it just reminds us that we do and can dream, and that we have that ability to be in these difficult situations, poverty, violence in certain areas, lack of opportunity. But you still have a dream somewhere. You still have something to look forward to. And I think it just reinforces that for young black men and women. You know, I'm a believer that my whole life is dedicated to helping those who are overlooked, those who are pushed down, those who injustices happen to. It tends to be in our country a lot, black and brown people. So it's definitely a reinforcement,
right,
of the dreams that we can have.
Speaking of dreams, let's talk about President Obama for 1 second. You performed an NPR Tiny Desk concert at the White House. First Lady Michelle Obama invited you to do a poetry reading at the White House. What was it like as a black man to do those things? What was it like to have a black man as president of the United States?
Well, you know, it was incredible to be in the White House performing songs like Letter to the Free, which is about the 13th Amendment and how slavery still exists in the form of mass incarceration and how this criminal justice system has tore down black families and brown families. And to be performing that in the White House while our first black president and first lady, It was a surreal moment.
Yeah.
It was a moment of hope for me in many ways because, like, you got to understand, Charles, it's one of those things where for a long time as a young black kid, you don't feel you are a part of the American story.
Right.
So when people are like, man, give it up for America and celebrate this about America, you're like, wait, America, y'all haven't really acknowledged me and my people, my ancestors, as part of this story and equal in this country. So to be at the White House was definitely a moment of inspiration for me. Won't be long. Southern leaves, southern trees we hung from. Barren souls, heroic songs unsung. Forgive them, Father, they know this knot is undone. Tied with the rope that my grandmother died. Pride of the pilgrims affect lives of millions. Since slave days, separating fathers from children. Institution ain't just a building, but a method of having black and brown bodies fill them. We ain't seen as human beings with feelings. Will the U.S. ever be us, Lord willing? For now we know the new Jim Crow, the stop, search, arrest of our souls. Police and policies patrol philosophies of control. A cruel hand take it hold. We let go to free them so we can free us. America's moment to come to Jesus. Come on. Freedom.
If I held the hope poster of Obama up now and you looked at it, what would you say?
That goes back to my belief in optimism. Optimism is not just only looking at what's in front of you. Hope has to do with also seeing things that may not be right there, tangible, right there in your face at the moment. It's having faith in the unseen. And I see a lot of hard times, but my hope and optimism also sees what's blossoming out of these hard times.
Like what? What's blossoming out? What's blossoming out of
this? I think humanity is blossoming out. Just starting from our young people, if you look at the youth generation is more and more taking hold of social impact and social activism. You know, I'll use the kids from Parkland as an example because they showed like, okay, this situation, one of the most difficult situations any human being can experience happened in our community. But not only are we going to be activists towards gun control and trying to halt these laws that continue to allow guns to be pushed to our society, but we're going to include the people who've been dealing with this struggle for a long time. Mm. And that's kids in Chicago, that's kids in D.C., that's kids in Miami, Atlanta, and Baltimore. So when I see those kids, include them and have conversations and bring that to the forefront, that shows me that people care about one another. Mm. When I see women, first and foremost, leading a movement, basically taking down all the sexual abuse and sexual harassment, man, that's powerful. That's bravery. Pardon me, my artery is martyry. Go hard to free those in poverty. Peace is a part of me, revolving me, involving me. I'm called to be. Follow, 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 follow me. I be living out of prophecy. Hey, living no apologies. Carmine, I want to be personal for 1 second with you. I want to ask about you. We're talking about some bigger political things and over things, but like... I thought you already been personal with me.
Oh, no, now we're getting really personal now. I want to quote you on one of your songs. This is Let Go. This is the August Green song. You say, out here with much anger inside me, don't know who my friends are, stranger inside me, stranger things getting high, clipped off my angel wings. Thought I was going to fly when Obama became the king. Pain and disdain are the rings that I wear. It's just the price of life when things ain't so fair. Mm-hmm. How do you carry that?
Well, let me be honest, Charles. When I'm writing from that perspective, I'm telling the story of things that I've experienced, but also things that my people experience. When I go home, when I call home, you know, and I'm saying home, Chicago, or even when I travel through any inner city, I feel the heart of the people. I feel the spirit. I feel the struggle of them. How do I write that, or what do I do in that situation is like what many people of color have had to do, and poor people in general have had to make it happen no matter what. Take the struggle and make it progress. As Frederick Douglass would always say, there's no struggle without progress, right?
Right.
There's no progress without struggle. Now, pain and disdain are the rings that I wear. That's like, honestly, we should have mental health support. We should have therapists around daily for people who I'm talking about who are dealing with this, including myself when I deal with it, you know? But I'm a believer in that spirituality is a real foundation for us as people to deal with issues and challenges that we have. Because when you operate on that God level, and in that love space, then you're able to, like, defeat a lot of the things that we encounter on a daily. And that doesn't mean you won't feel it at all.
Right.
And I'm saying that to say that's how we deal with it in some ways.
You know, it's funny. I'm thinking about the Christian liberation theologians from the 60s and 70s. They radically saw God as a verb, as an kind of an active liberator of the oppressed. How do you see God?
I see God as the creator of all things good. I see God is in all of us. God is in the trees, the sun.
Yeah.
And I do believe God is in action, meaning we can only express God if we do. You can go to church, you can go to temple, you can go to whatever form of worship. But if you don't act, if you don't do, then God is not really being expressed. Let me be clear, Charles. I'm a believer in Jesus Christ, but I also believe that brothers that study Islam and sisters that study Islam, it's a truth in that. It's a truth in that. I believe that Buddhists have a truth in what they believe. I can't tell you how to have your relationship with the Creator. I can say to you, man, have a spiritual foundation that you believe in. I'm glad you cited that lyric, man. Thanks for listening, because that I don't know if many people caught that, but that's what, when I was thinking about a lot of the change that has to happen in our communities, it's going to take our spirituality, because we're battling against so many everyday ills and evils that are on man level. But when we rise above on God level, it's like, you can't defeat us.
Right.
We can't be taken down. And I've seen some of the richest people spirit-wise in some of the poorest places, and that lets me know that spirituality can overcome the world's ills.
There's places I go I can't tell you about. I need to let go.
Sitting in the shadow of me, gradually battling me, a fall from grace like Adam and Eve. Search for the...
That's Common, Talking Hope with Charles Monroe Kane. And we've been listening to Optimistic, the debut album of his new supergroup, August Green.
Out here with much anger inside me. Don't know who my friends are, stranger inside me. Stranger things, getting high, clipped off my angel wings. Thought I was gonna fly when Obama became the king. Pain and disdain are the rings that I wear. It's just the price of life when things ain't as fair.
It's places I go, I can't tell you about.
So our question this hour was, how do you make hope? And I don't want to break the mood, but our three-part series continues with the question that keeps many of us up at night. Are we doomed?
I cried twice when my daughter was born. The first time for joy, and the second time for sorrow. It was 10 or 15 minutes after she'd been born, and I was holding her, this brand new life, looking out the window. I didn't know what to say to her. I'd brought her into this world and not fully grasped what that would mean for her life.
That's next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge.
I need to live.